Since 2005, Blue Hat has been where the security research community and Microsoft come together as peers
to debate and discuss, share and challenge, celebrate and learn.
On the Blue Hat podcast, join me, Nick Fillingham,
and me, Wendy Zanoni, for conversations with researchers, responders and industry leaders, both inside and outside of Microsoft,
working to secure the planet's technology and create a safer world for all.
And now, on with the Blue Hat podcast.
Welcome to the Blue Hat podcast, Luke Jennings. Luke, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Luke, you are dialing in from London, England. So thank you so much for doing that, for braving the time zones and the digital Atlantic crossing. You were here in person for Blue Hat October 2023, which was the last Blue Hat conference, where you presented for us. We're going to talk about your session and some of the findings and the work that you do in today's episode. But first, could we please get a little introduction? Who is Luke Jennings?
Sure. Okay, thank you. Well, I'm VP of R&D at Push Security. So we're kind of focused on securing cloud identities and sort of SaaS security and that kind of thing. So I'm really at the moment focused on sort of forward-looking research in that space, looking into how the threat landscape is changing in that space and also, you know, using that to help and improve the product features we offer. So that's really where the research came from that led me to this space. Prior to that, you know, I've got quite a traditional sort of red teaming background originally, and then I moved into the sort of detection and response space as well, and kind of designed an EDR product and did that kind of thing. And that led me on to Push eventually, moving into the sort of into the future of security looking forward.
And your foray into red teaming, did that come from a misspent youth? Did that come from anything fun in, you know, high school? You know, did you, were you hacking your PlayStation? How did you get into that?
I started coding from a very young age. Like I sort of learned QBasic back in the day when I was very young. And then later on, I decided I wanted to learn a sort of a more proper language, which at the time I decided was C++. So when I was sort of into my teens, I started learning C++. I didn't really do too much on the security side, to be honest, until I kind of got into actually my career. I went to university to study computer science. So I was on that pathway and I was always interested in the idea of hacking, but I really didn't learn too much about security until I kind of got into it professionally halfway through my degree. But yeah, that's the sort of what led me to it anyway.
What was the first hacking thing that you did that made you say, this is amazing?
I think, if anything, I started doing a summer internship for NWR, which is the company I spent most of my career when they were a tiny startup. And to be honest, even just from the first day, being shown some things I'd never thought about before was really interesting, because it was just web app security at the time, and someone was doing a web app test and finding some SQL injection. And at the time, I'd done a lot of coding, but I didn't really do web app stuff. So web apps were new to me anyway. And then seeing like SQL injection, which was, I guess, relatively new at the time, we're talking mid-2000s, you know, most apps seem to be vulnerable to it. I just never considered those kind of issues. So like, even just from that starting point, it kind of gave me that seed where I was like, okay, I need to learn about this. Like, I need to learn that and the 100 or 1,000 probable other things there are. And then, yeah, I just piled my way through books and asked a million questions and tried lots of different things and went on that pathway from that first day.
I love that. I love the origin stories.
And Luke, this wasn't your first time at Blue Hat. You've presented at a Blue Hat before, is that correct?
I have, yeah. So the first time I went to Blue Hat and presented was 2018. And that was quite a different topic. So that was on like memory resident implants. And that really came out of a combination of sort of my red teaming days and a lot of work I'd done at Countercept on the detection and response side. So like actually investigating and detecting memory resident implants. So yeah, that was my first one. And it was a great con. So I thought, I'd like to go back again. 2019, I went just as an attendee. And then, yeah, the opportunity to submit again for 2023 and luckily was accepted. And so got to go along as a speaker for the second time.
Memory resident implant, that's a new one for me. I'm conjuring Blade Runner 2049 and all that kind of stuff. TLDR, what's a memory resident implant?
Okay, so yeah, I was really focused on implant. If you compromise an endpoint and you want to maintain control of it and have some sort of implant on there, if you stay off of disk and keep everything mostly just running in memory, you know, not running from an actual executable that maps the disk, then traditionally that was quite stealthy and gave you a lot of sort of options for hiding. There's lots of different ways you can do it. And essentially, I'd spent quite a lot of time in my Countercept days looking into that, because certain common attack frameworks use that technique, like Cobalt Strikes Beacon, for example, and other frameworks now. So I'd done a lot of work in trying to detect those techniques, and particularly doing it at scale. And I was talking about that, so, and my experiences doing it and what we'd seen picking it up in the real world.
Are there other phrases, terminology, taxonomy for that type of attack or that sort of technique? I'm just wondering if maybe listeners have they know of this, but of a different name, or maybe I just have no idea what I'm talking about, which would not be the first.
Sure. No, I mean, I guess the most common technique people are probably familiar with would be like reflective DLL loading and other types of techniques that map DLLs into memory without going through the standard loading process, and then having threads that then run from those unbacked regions and so forth. So it's those kind of techniques. And like, as the sort of cat and mouse game evolved, there were some slightly more esoteric examples people started coming up with to get around, you know, certain detection methods. But yeah, that's the that was the core of it.
And is there any connective tissue between that topic, or at least the way that you got interested about the memory resident artifacts, and what you came to present at Blue Hat October 2023, which was on this new SaaS cyber kill chain?
Really, almost no connection in the sense I literally actually forced myself to not use any techniques from that sort of era. So I think, yeah, with this research, it was very much a case of saying, look, let's say I'm attacking an organization and they don't have any infrastructure. They're a very new, modern organization. They're purely using cloud and SaaS services, SSO, MFA, all these things. That, okay, they've got endpoints, but let's assume they're so well secured that I can't compromise them. What do I do? So I was actually really tying my hands behind my back and leaving all that knowledge behind and going from there. So no, there's actually no connection in this case. But yeah, that was the approach I took with the new research.
And for those that have not had a chance to go onto YouTube and watch your talk, the presentation that you gave at Blue Hat, if you could give us an overview of what this presentation was about, what you discussed, what are some key points that you went over for the listeners to understand?
Sure. So yeah, I mean, I was starting from a point of saying, okay, look, there's a lot of smaller companies out there now are fully SaaS native, don't have network infrastructure anymore, maybe entirely working from home as well. There are larger companies that are mostly hybrid SaaS in the sense of, yes, they've still got all that old infrastructure, but they're probably increasingly using SaaS services. How do I, as an attacker, attack them? Why are we not seeing more examples of this? Is security solved now if you get rid of all that infrastructure? Is that it? Do we not need to do anything anymore because it's all good? And it was hard to begin with, because I think, as I mentioned before, it was kind of I was pretty much throwing out all my existing career knowledge and saying none of that stuff that I've been an expert at before I can use now. And it just started small. So it was like, okay, think of small techniques that might be viable for doing some type of attack against a company like that. And as I built up a few examples in different SaaS services of small different techniques, I was looking to start connecting them up into a sort of a kill chain method. So like something like the MITRE ATT&CK framework that has, you know, kill chain phases. I was thinking about similar kill chain phases for this. And even at the high level, thinking, do the same phases even exist in this new world? So I was kind of looking into that, trying to understand what phases look like. So, you know, what does lateral movement look like when there's no infrastructure to move around in? What concept does that have in this new space? And what attack techniques can fit within those things? And as I found out more, you know, it was like I gradually built up more and more techniques, some of them being techniques that everyone would be fairly familiar with, but have slightly new flavors in this world. So even simple things like password guessing attacks, but how does that work when you've got, you know, 100 different SaaS apps that you're using as opposed to one SSO portal, for example? And also some kind of more esoteric, quite new attacks that apply in this world, and gradually build that up. And that's kind of the journey I went on building the research that led to this. So the presentation itself is all about that. And then eventually I built it into a new cyber kill chain effectively. So it's like, what does this kill chain look like in this new space?
So is this in a sense, let's say companies are relying on various SaaS vendors, you know, to, as you were mentioning. So for example, somehow an attacker is able to look at a company's calendar. And in that calendar, there are links to documents. Those documents also are not locked down. They're able to find access through these other channels instead of just going straight through the company. So, you know, I'll go through the calendar and then I'll go through the document. And then through that document, I can access all these other things that people didn't think that they needed to be concerned about. Is that on the right path or is that very different?
No, that could fit within it. So, I mean, in a way, that might be an example of lateral movement, like finding links between different SaaS apps and connections there. So rather than, you know, if you make a small compromise, rather than in the old world where you'd have compromised an endpoint and you then move from there to a server or to another endpoint, here you might be on one SaaS app, find some information and a link and a reference to another. And there may already be a way to authenticate to that other app with the means that you already have, which means you then move laterally to that one. So, yeah, it's like that kind of thing does fit with this in this space. The general point being, how do you compromise a cloud identity that allows you access to some level of SaaS app in the first place? And then once you've got access to them, how do you then move around? And that can be through lots of different means.
And so, Luke, as you were sort of thinking through, okay, I'm going to throw everything away that I know and am an expert in. I'm going to think about this new breed of organization that is born in the cloud, cloud only, doesn't have endpoints to compromise in the traditional sense. And so you built this new framework. Was that because there isn't an existing framework from an organization like a MITRE that talks about this scenario? Or was it more that you felt that there was an even newer or different or more sort of nuanced angle to this? I feel like born in the cloud and cloud only, you know, these are concepts that have been around for a little while now. So I guess I'm sort of thinking the framework that you've developed here, how does it differ from either the MITRE ATT&CK framework or some other framework that the industry is sort of, you know, familiar with?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons. MITRE does have like a cloud matrix and a SaaS matrix, but they're obviously nowhere near as developed as the general enterprise framework that's focused on your sort of traditional endpoint and infrastructure attacks. I think the other aspect is that MITRE traditionally was focused on, like when the attack framework came out, it was looking at existing real-world attacks that are happening and documenting the techniques by what threat actors using them as well. And so in this space, I was looking and thinking, I'm trying to look into what's going to happen. Maybe that isn't happening right now, but what could happen and what probably will happen. And in general, I was just finding so many new things that it wasn't something I intended to publish originally. But as I built up the research internally for our own purposes and started looking at it, I started thinking I should put this information out there. There was no sort of competition with existing frameworks at that point. It was just I've got a lot of information here and I've gone about it in a way where I've 100% laser focused on this area. And I think it's going to be interesting to other people. So why not release it in an open source format on GitHub? And given that it's forward looking and it's something that's actually going to be changing rapidly in future, probably that's a perfect opportunity for other people to, you know, contribute to an open source project as and when research picks up further as this area develops. So that's, I think, yeah, kind of what led to the way I released it.
Yeah, I love that clarification and thank you for that, because I think while you definitely have said the words forward looking, and I think that was in your abstract too for the session, I guess for me, I did think of it more of like, oh, here's a competing framework as to what's already out there. But no, what you're researching new techniques, new ideas, new concepts, and you're actually painting a picture of what potentially could sort of happen moving forward, as opposed to, as you say, some of the frameworks that we're used to in the industry are built on looking backwards at attacks that have happened, either successful or partial or not, and then sort of pulling them apart and then putting them into a framework. You're sort of looking forward. Assuming I got that correct, then I think that's a really fascinating way to sort of look at this this new framework that you've got. And we'll make sure that the links are in the show notes to the episode.
Yes, no, that makes total sense. And although I started out that way, and it's not been that long, I would say the interesting thing is that we're already starting to see more evidence of threat actors starting to use some of these types of techniques too. So it might become backward looking fairly quickly.
In your talk, you mentioned the concept of initial access. Can you explain what that is? Why is that a critical stage, a critical point in the whole kill chain process? Can you give us a little more information about that?
Sure, yeah. So I think with initial access, we're normally talking about, if you're referring to an external attacker, you're talking about the phase where you first go from having no access beyond information you've got doing recon and going to that first sort of foothold in a network. So traditionally, that's normally something like compromising an endpoint with a low privileged user in control of it and moving from there. So in the SaaS space, we're generally speaking about compromising your first cloud identity or some level of access to a SaaS app that's in use by an organization. And that's your sort of first foothold at that point. Say, okay, I've got some level of access to at least one account that has access to at least one SaaS app. That's like your sort of minimal atomic kind of initial access movement. So that's, I think, the phase as it applies to SaaS kind of based attacks.
Do you see any value, or I can't say if there's value or not, no value, but you know, when folks are onboarding, I mean, ideally in a company, if someone wants to onboard a SaaS application, you go through a security review and, you know, the folks send out a SigLite or whatever they choose to use, and you go through all the questionnaires. Do you see any value in that? Does that help mitigate any of this? Or is that like a more of a compliance check? You know, let's get the high level. Yeah, we're comfortable. What are you doing with our data? But this is definitely more complicated, and it doesn't really impact whether or not attackers have access or are able to gain access. Are those two totally separate areas?
No, I think it's obviously good for an organization to know what SaaS apps are in use and be able to go through security processes and review processes for that. I think if anything, the issue is SaaS is designed to be really easy to start using. And it, you know, most SaaS apps, like, users want to use them. And a lot of the vendors out there sort of follow a product-led growth marketing strategy where they kind of try to get users on board and bottom up first. So I think the issue generally, particularly in larger organizations, is that unless you proactively try to discover what SaaS apps are in use in your organization, you will probably find there is a lot more out there informally used as like shadow SaaS than you're aware of. So you won't necessarily be able to go through those review processes easily by someone sort of requesting to use something. So I think, yes, review processes are good, but discovery is really the first point. And then the other point from there is there's often so many that it's difficult to, from a scale perspective, go through formal lengthy review processes for every single one. So then you need to think about how do you sort of prioritize what are the ones that are worth spending more time looking at. And, you know, there's various strategies you can employ there, but it's, yeah, I think that's the kind of approach that I would normally take in this space.
Tiering the vendors makes sense.
Luke, there's a couple of techniques I would love to ask you about, because they were certainly new to me hearing your presentation of Blue Hat. But before we jump into some of those, I just thought I've got your framework in front of me here. I brought up your GitHub page. And so if I just sort of read the categories, the top row here, so it starts with reconnaissance, then it's initial access, execution, persistence, privilege escalation, defense evasion, credential access, discovery, lateral movement, and exfiltration. I wanted to just quickly read those because I wanted to ask for folks, again, just sort of looking for that frame of reference that they're sort of familiar with the MITRE ATT&CK framework, they're familiar with other concepts. Which of those, if any, would you sort of highlight and say, this is the sort of category that is the most different or the most unique now that we're in this sort of looking forward, semi-theoretical, SaaS-only world?
And
it's okay to say none, and then we can just move on to some of the techniques, because I have some juicy techniques I want to ask you about.
Yeah, they're all interesting. I mean, I think if you want to just pick three phases to sort of learn how they've changed in this space, for example, out of all of those, I'd probably say initial access, lateral movement, and persistence. It's hard for me to pick one. I mean, maybe if I had to pick one, I'd say persistence, because it's actually quite scary the number of methods you can use for persistence across SaaS apps now. And the other aspect is that from a pure economics perspective, in terms of the amount of work you need to do as an incident responder to combat persistence post-compromise, that's actually quite alarming as well. Because in the traditional world, like if someone compromises an endpoint and you catch them early, you've only really got one endpoint account to worry about, and it's not too bad. Then you kind of disconnect it from the network, wipe the laptop, do forensics, you know, all those kind of things, but it's limited. With SaaS, even if you compromise one single user, you might be able to persist on in a different way as that user on every single SaaS app they use. And if they use 50 apps, then even from a single user compromise scenario, you might have 50 different persistence mechanisms on different apps to be thinking about. So that's a pretty interesting phase. They're all interesting, but that's just one example.
Yeah, and so that's a great segue then into, you know, some of these new techniques I wanted to ask about. And the first one was evil twin integration. This is something that you talk about in the session, and I think you give a demo of that. Obviously, we have limited time here on the podcast, but what is an evil twin integration, and what's the TLDR for our audience?
Okay, that's one of the more advanced ones, so I'll do a little bit of background.
I'll give you 30 seconds. Sorry.
Okay, so OAuth is a key mechanism for delegating access to different SaaS apps. So you can use OAuth with your user account to allow different SaaS apps some level of access into your account. So you might allow an app access to your email or access to your files. Maybe you use Canva for things, and then you want to send something from Canva to your OneDrive, so you delegate access to your OneDrive. So OAuth is already something that has different security implications in different phases. It can be used for consent phishing in the initial access phase, and it can be used for persistent phase, set up OAuth integrations to maintain access to an account even after the password's changed or MFA is reset and that sort of thing. It's also lateral movement, because you might find an OAuth connection in an existing app you've compromised and use that to move elsewhere. But the interesting thing is if someone sets up a new OAuth integration, you can, as a defender, look for new permission grants and new OAuth apps. So at an organizational level, if an OAuth app you've never seen before for a SaaS app you've never used before gets integrated by a user, you could, you know, set up an alert and say, tell me about that. Say, oh, okay, someone's just integrated this particular SaaS platform. Maybe it's a legit platform, or maybe it's a malicious app, but you could see that. If you then approve that and then a different user integrates it, okay, it's maybe not as high priority, but you could still say, okay, it's an existing app we know about, but this is a new user has just granted permissions, and are we okay with that as well? Do we want to go down to that level and approve every user? Now, what happens with evil twin integrations is the idea is if you find a user that's already integrated a legitimate SaaS app, so they've already been approved, that app is in use at the organizational level, and that user is a user of it, and you've compromised their account. And that could be something like a powerful automation platform like Microsoft Power Automate or Zapier or any one of those kind of tools. An attacker could set up a separate tenant that they control on Zapier, for example, and then make a new OAuth integration from that as the same user. But from a defender's perspective, it doesn't necessarily look like anything new has occurred, because that app's already in use and that user has already granted the permissions. Assuming the attacker doesn't need new permissions and they're happy using the existing ones that are there, so you don't see a new app appear and you don't see new permission grants. But really, you've got two different Zapier tenants. You've got the legitimate one that the user was using in the first place, and then you've got a malicious one that an attacker has set up. And so I've kind of classified this, you know, evil twin integrations as a defense evasion technique, because the idea is it's very difficult as a defender to see that there's two tenants in play there and that one of them is malicious. So if someone does something like that, it's actually very hard to see that a sneaky persistence mechanism has been set up there, because they're just reintegrating something that already existed, and they maintain control of their one, and the user's existing legitimate one stays in place too. And yeah, I decided to call that an evil twin integration.
Yeah, and you've got a demo of it in your session recording, which was fascinating to see and to sort of, it would be good, I think, for listeners of the podcast that are interested in this to see that demo, to sort of wrap their head around it sort of more tactically. Do you also provide sort of guidance or some early sort of thinking on how to detect evil twin integrations, how to sort of build rules to potentially, sniff them out if they exist?
So this is one of the ones that I highlighted as a very hard to detect technique. So I don't have any magic answers for that particular one.
Okay.
At this point, I've highlighted it as a concern that goes beyond just looking for normal OAuth consents, because it's a situation you need to be concerned about. It doesn't mean you can't see anything. Like if you look down to the sort of activity logs level of like what is the integration doing, you may be able to then see evidence of it, but you kind of need to know what you're looking for at that point. So I think the example I gave in the video, if I'm remembering correctly in my presentation, was an existing legitimate integration was uploading files to a file store, and then the illegitimate one used the same permissions to start reading and stealing information from that file store. Now, you might not have seen that it was two different integrations, but if you went to look down at the activity level, you'd see that previously, every time this integration activated, it was always uploading files of a certain type of format and so forth, and that was the legitimate activity. And then one day, it starts downloading loads of files completely differently. So you could go and see at that level that something different occurred. It's obviously quite difficult to purely detect that if you have nothing else to go on. You're trying to look for something that changes its behavior. And we all know that's quite a tricky thing to do at scale for pure detection. But certainly, if you're at a point where you've got an idea that someone might have done something like this, and you're aware of it as a technique, it does enable you to then sort of cast a more detailed eye on the sort of lower level logs and have a look at what's going on.
So I assume the solution would be to strictly lock down what folks can download, what they can use. I worked for a company years ago that it was more on the honor system, so everyone can download everything. It's just we had this list of here are things we suggest you don't, and it's up to you. And I was on the corporate security team, and it was the biggest nightmare ever. But I like companies that have more the, if you try to download this, you cannot, because we know, like, I know we have a few of those applications that I've been kind of like blocked on. It's like, okay, I get it. But I assume that's probably the better solution, is just to have an approved list and then you only monitor those versus just having a free-for-all where you don't know what, like you were saying, people download things and use things without permission all the time. But having a more structured methodology on what SaaS apps people can use is probably, I would assume, minimizes a lot of this. Or like, what is your opinion? What's the best way to avoid a lot of these attacks? How can we avoid this?
Yeah, I think we're so early in this phase that I have some answers, I feel, but there's a lot for us to learn still. I think it's going to be a wider industry discovery process. Going back to one of the things I said previously, for me, I think the first point is just discovery, because you could say you want to lock down things from the start, but people want to use these apps, and it's the whole way the whole technology industry has moved. And the reality is, especially if you're a large company, you're going to find that there's way more in use than you're aware of. So I think it's very difficult to actually try and just lock all this down and keep things limited to a few different apps anyway. So I think the visibility point and then kind of risk minimization, trying to make sure that most apps will be relatively low impact if certain parts of them were compromised, and focusing on the sort of higher risk integrations and that kind of thing, while enabling your employees to use them as securely as possible with your full knowledge is a sort of general high level strategy that I would recommend. But I'm sure there's going to be lots more detail that we're all going to discover as time goes on and this becomes more normal and attacks in this space become more normal, and that will adapt over time.
I worked on a project once where our job was to find all the SaaS applications that the company was using. We came up with like 900 and something. Fast forward, there were 30,000 that were being used. We only knew of 900 of them. So to your point, that's insane. There's a lot of unknown apps out there that people are using just in a company.
Yeah, no, the shadow sales problem is huge. And yeah, like whenever we have new customers come on board, like apart from like the smallest organizations that are fully cloud native and, you know, they just inherently know everything when it's like 10 people. But beyond that, yeah, it's always, the discovery point is always a lot more apps than anyone ever envisaged. So yeah, I think that's the first problem to start on. And the other point is, even if people are signing up for these things, there's no guarantee they're even doing it with like corporate addresses. Because, I mean, they can sign in with just usernames and passwords. They might use their corporate email. They might use a personal one. So you've got that issue to contend with as well. Sometimes it might be something they were using personally to begin with, and then one day they want to use it for something for work. So they didn't even sign up for it specifically for a work purpose, but they realize it would really be helpful if I use that app right now that I use in my personal life. And they just log into it and start using it. So there's a lot of blended use cases to be aware of. But yeah, I mean, definitely the sheer scale is always bigger than people anticipate.
Luke, for researchers and responders listening to this podcast, watching your recording, heading to the GitHub page and sort of learning more, you mentioned this framework is open source. It's on GitHub. Where are you hoping to see sort of more contributions, more research, more proof of concept, more sort of expansion of this work? You know, anything particular you'd like to point people at, or is there any area that you're personally diving, you know, even deeper into to sort of develop this framework out even further?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's multiple levels for expansion and contribution, really. I mean, at the sort of highest level, we've just got new techniques. You know, if there's like a fully new technique that makes sense to be in this space, then great, let's get it in the matrix. But also, this is where the scale problem becomes really hard, is just examples of those techniques and whether or not they apply to different SaaS apps is useful. So when I first made it, I tried to make sure there was generally at least one example of a real world SaaS app that it applied to as an example reference. But the more we've got there, the better. I mean, in an ideal world, every single technique, we'd have a documentation of whether or not it applied to what any one of 1,000 different SaaS apps. You know, obviously that's a huge undertaking, but anything along those lines would be really useful for contribution too. And I think as we start seeing real world attacks using some of these techniques, that's a critical piece too. So if we start, you know, if we're going to start seeing real world threat actors perform some of these attacks more, then getting references and evidence in of that, so people can sort of focus on the ones that we've actually started to be seen exploited in the real world, is useful too. I've been personally trying to keep it up to date with as and when I find new techniques or new examples, and adding useful references for lots of things, which also includes threat actor examples too. But like anything in that space is of value, I think.
And is there a dashboard, for want of a better term, but of your framework, do you have metrics to show which do have real world examples, either hypothetical or actual sort of attacks that have been undertaken and then publicly disclosed? Like, are you tracking that so that if someone does stumble upon something that they think is potentially something that could be added to the framework, that they'll be able to sort of easily know where it could slot in?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got the discussions page on GitHub, and we've also just got the issues for submitting issues. So those can be used for contributions there. In terms of like which ones, a matrix of which ones have got real world examples already, right now it's kind of more informal. It's just we've got references in techniques where we've seen them and added them with a note, but we don't have like a table with ticks and crosses of exactly which ones have had a real threat actor example seen. But I mean, we may very well add things like that in future if it makes sense to do so, particularly as we start seeing more real world attacks in the space anyway. It might make sense to have one.
Can we digest this whole episode with some key takeaways that you have for the audience?
Sure, yeah, of course. We've covered a lot of ground and it's a whole new area. So if I try and think about the most key points in this space, first one I'd say is just the threat landscape is changing, or it has changed, and it's rapidly changing now. So it's really worth getting across these issues if you're new to it, because I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of them. Otherwise, you know, it's it's possible to compromise an organization without touching the endpoint and stuff now. So you can compromise a fully cloud-native, SaaS-native organization. Shadow SaaS is a real problem as well that people need to be looking into more. And so these issues, these don't only affect small startups that have started as fully SaaS-native, fully remote kind of companies like modern workforces now. These issues affect the largest enterprises out there too. Like everyone has some level of SaaS use, and generally the bigger an organization you are, probably the larger percentage of SaaS use is in place that you just don't know about because it's shadow SaaS. So you really, even if you're a large enterprise, you really need to be thinking about these things. And beyond that, I think it's just, I see us at the beginning of a new era of cyber attacks here. I think if I look back to once upon a time when I was focused on like perimeter attacks and web app attacks and Wi-Fi hacking and that kind of thing, and then it got harder and harder, and one day people started compromising endpoints instead, and command and control frameworks came out, and it was a huge sudden shift in the threat landscape. I think we're at that point again now, like where we're going to see a big shift, which comes partly through, you know, those sort of endpoint-oriented attacks having become more and more difficult as there's more and more security controls in place to deal with them, and partly because of just the changing higher level technology landscape, in the sense of people are moving towards working in this way without infrastructure and with SaaS solutions. And so attackers are going to be forced to move this way if they haven't already.
When you're not hacking, when you're not researching, when you're not heads down in this work, what do you like to do outside of that? Do you for entertainment? Do you have any hobbies?
Sure. Given my job involves sitting on a chair all day, I try to have some active hobbies outside of that. So like I train Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I like skiing. I'm going to the Alps in less than a week, actually. I like cycling. I like mountain biking. So yeah, so I've got that sort of active side. And then I also play guitar. So not as much as I used to, but I do still sometimes. And otherwise, I don't know, I'm British, so going for a pint down the pub with my friends, of course, has to be on the list.
I assume you've been to Black Hat in Vegas.
Yeah.
Have you ever participated in the jiu-jitsu smackdowns that are organized out there during that? I think Jeremiah Grossman organizes them, so everyone, all the security folks that are into jiu-jitsu come and do whatever they do. Have you participated in that?
I have heard of them. And yeah, and I know he's a black belt. He's been doing it for a long time. I haven't been to Vegas since I started BJJ. So
it's the reason
I haven't had an opportunity there. But if I go back at some time, I might bring my stuff with me, yeah, and join up.
That sounds awesome.
Luke, before we let you go, where can we follow your endeavors and exploits on the interwebs and or in person if you're presenting at any conferences coming up?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I generally, if I release new research, I generally put it on Twitter. So my Twitter handle is JukeLennings, Duke Lennings. So other than that, I'd say, yeah, keep an eye out for conference presentations. Keep an eye on the Push Security blog where I put my blog posts. In terms of conference presentations, I'll be speaking at SpectreOps's conference in March. So that's my next one, and it'll be similar topics to this.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being a part of the most recent Blue Hat, for being a part of Blue Hat 2018, for coming to Blue Hat 2019, for supporting the community, and being on the podcast. Luke, we'd love to chat to you on another episode at another time. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It's been great to be on.
Thank you for joining us for the Blue Hat Podcast.
If you have feedback, topic requests, or questions about this episode,
please email us at bluehat@microsoft.com or message us on Twitter at @MSFTBlueHat.
Be sure to subscribe for more conversations and insights from security researchers and responders across the industry
by visiting bluehatpodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.